is entitled How to Make the Masters More Real. It's my pleasure now to ask Jeffrey Hudson to address us. Thank you.
Arthur and fellow members, our subject for this morning is so far-reaching in its implications, both philosophical and intellectual, and of course spiritual, that it is quite impossible to deal fully, even adequately, with it in one address. Fortunately, theosophical literature contains many works dealing directly with both the subject of the masters themselves and the possibility of discipleship under one or other of them. I presume it is true to say that in order to understand any subject at all thoroughly, one must make oneself acquainted with the underlying principles upon which it is based. And so may I begin by briefly stating those principles as I understand them. We, each one of us, for example, as members of the human race, we are those beings in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are united by intellect. Man's spiritual nature, self, monad, perpetually unfolds potential capacities. This being the result of his existence, unfoldment. And this process culminates in the human kingdom in the attainment of perfected manhood, adeptship. Method, we know full well, human evolution is achieved by means of successive lives, reincarnation, rebirth. Our conditions and our experiences are all the results of our conduct under the law of cause and effect, or karma. Kindness brings health and happiness. Cruelty brings disease and misery. Theosophical bases. But this morning we are dealing with another, which is that the processes of evolution can be hastened. The kingdom of heaven can be taken by storm. And this calls for self-training, regular meditation, and selfless service. As a result, century by century, a perfect man arises, or woman, the rare efflorescence, flowering of the human race, an adept appears. Thus, perfected men and women, adepts, do exist upon our planet. They are the elder brethren of humanity. And fortunately for humanity, some of them take and train disciples. And our subject for this morning is how these teachings, especially concerning the existence of the adepts, may be made real, more real to us. The answers presumably are numerous. Amongst them, in general, a complete acceptance, intellectual and intuitional, of the principle and the fact of the existence of masters of the wisdom with ourselves here as occupants of this planet. The masters of the wisdom do exist. And one way in which perhaps one might make oneself aware of this fact might be when hearing of or reading about a particular master, an interior response occurs. Something happens within one, and one feels drawn to one or other of those named. I suppose, yes, that is the intuitive response. And concerning the intuition, Dr. Albert Einstein has written, as doubtless you know, the intellect has little to do on the road to discovery. There comes a leap in consciousness. Call it intuition or what you will. And the solution comes to you, and you don't know how or why. All, he goes on, all great discoveries are made in this way. This is one of the greatest of all discoveries. Realization of the existence of the masters and, by chance, of a relationship with one or other of them. Perhaps, yes, perhaps when one hears the name of a master, whether it's the head of one's own religion or one of the great rishis of the past or in other religions, and one responds like that intuitionally, it might possibly mean that we have known that master in an earlier life. Perhaps one has been associated with that master, even a disciple. In the new life, one doesn't remember, but various events happen which can cause the intuition to leap into life, and at once there's a response from within. Ah, yes, it is to him, it is to this one that I belong. Then the whole question of our subject, in a way, is answered. The mention of the master's name evokes an intuitional response which may be based upon an earlier memory. I'm tempted to say that our membership of this society in this life isn't a new experience for the ego. For all those for whom these teachings leap to life as true, or are patiently studied, or are followed, or are taught, may very well have been in relationship both with a great teacher in a former life and with this great subject of Theosophia. Well, supposing it is so, one's interested in the subject, or in a particular adept, or there awakens a longing for discipleship, to come near to the Master, if only to be, and especially to be, a more effective servant of one's fellow men, then what? Well, I suppose, first and foremost, singleness of motive. Easy to say, how difficult to assure. Purity of heart. This can lead to the great privilege to become a more effective servant of humanity in his name and representing him out in the world. Here, very deep conviction is important. Also, being in, if I may use a rather colloquial term, being in dead earnest. Dedicating one's spare time wisely for the fulfillment of their objective. We have to popularize a knowledge of Theosophy. And the motive, the amelioration of the condition of man. Two motives only. To participate in the fulfillment of those two purposes for the founding of the Theosophical Society and its predecessors throughout the ages. And so, study for certain temperaments is also necessary, particularly of all the sources in the scriptures of the world and in theosophical literature, which fortunately is so rich in such information. This is important, this study, because realism and truth in any field of thought depends upon correct, accurate, precise understanding and knowledge of one's subject. It's a fatal mistake, if I may say so, to form an opinion, and still worse to act upon it, before one has made oneself fully acquainted with all the facts. So important. So realism, I suggest, in any field of thought, depends upon correct, accurate, precise understanding and knowledge of one subject. Fortunately for us, that knowledge is available in the wonderful books known, of course, to all of you. The Voice of the Silence, by H.P. Blavatsky, Light on the Path by Mabel Collins, The Ideal of the White Lotus, also by Mabel Collins, and the summing up, could I say, of the whole idea deal in what is known as the Golden Stairs. H.P. Blavatsky has handed on to us, she says, from an earlier source, the necessities for each and every human being who would like to begin stepping out of the human limitations towards the powers of service of the members of the superhuman kingdom. I expect you know them, but may I just repeat some of them? Important to our subject. A clean life, an open mind, a pure heart, an eager intellect, an unveiled spiritual perception, a brave declaration of principles, a valiant defense of those who are unjustly attacked, and a constant eye to the ideal of human progression and perfection, which the sacred science depicts. These are the golden stairs, up the steps of which the learner may climb to the temple of divine wisdom. And so, further answer to the question of our title, read theosophical literature on the subject of the masters. And for those temperamentally responding, the letters from the masters of the wisdom, those to A.P. Sinnett, and the very beautiful two series edited and presented by our brother Jinaraja Dasa under the title Letters from the Masters of the Wisdom. They're not heavy reading, these last ones. They're nearly all short. They're beautiful letters giving advice and encouragement to early ES members in their problems and their difficulties, and especially in the fulfillment of their aspirations towards adeptship.
The Masters on the Path.
What, dear?
The Masters on the Path, C.W.
Yes, and thank you, Sandra. And, of course, The Masters and the Path by C.W. Leadbeater. In these works we learn, yes, the names of the Master, where they are living and working, their particular offices in the great hierarchy of the adepts of our planet. One learns, for example, that in Egypt there still exists the Brotherhood of Luxor, of which HBB said she was a member. And we even know the names of some of the members of the Egyptian Brotherhood and can read their writings. The Master Serapis Bey, referred to by another master as the youngest of the Chohans. That's a stage in adeptic evolution. For, of course, this great process doesn't cease when this attainment has been achieved, adeptship, beyond that again, unending indeed, are greater heights which to ascend. Chohan is a title, means Lord in Sanskrit, generally I understand, applied to those who not only have reached adeptship, the fifth great initiation, but the next stage, the sixth initiation, Serapis Bay. In other words, the master Tuitit Bay of the Brotherhood of Luxor. There's a very interesting story connected with him, with all of them, but one connected with him, the master Tuitit Bay. In the early days of the founding of our society, when H.P. Blavatsky and Colonel Alcott were living in America and at work and writing articles for various magazines, especially the spiritualistic magazines. And the colonel was suggested to the colonel that he should write one to one of the spiritualist magazines. Well, he was a lawyer and a colonel and a minister of agriculture, a hard-headed American yet responding to idealism so wonderfully, so faithfully, and he sat down and he wrote his article. And when he'd written it, he took it and placed it in the hands of HPB and said, "Oh, I've done as I was requested." She picked it up and she burst out laughing. He said, "Why, what is the matter?" She said, "Look at the initials of each paragraph." And lo and behold, each paragraph began with T, U, I, T, I, T. So that he had been inspired without knowing it by this particular great master, the revered Master Tuitit Bay. And then, of course, there is the great Egyptian adept, the Master Hilarion, and that mighty one who long ago appeared in Palestine and was then known as Jesus, still named by us the Master Jesus. An adept now, a high one doubtless, and residing somewhere in secrecy in Lebanon. With all the events in Lebanon today, and Sandra and I often wonder how the masters retain their privacy. But of course their powers are so wonderful that we need have no doubts upon such ability. So there, somewhere up doubtless amongst the mountains of Lebanon, there is a secret organization over which there presides one who was the Master Jesus in the country of the Druzes. Which brings back to me by the bio-memory. Yes, in this very city. I was asked on one of my privileged visits to buy a cross for a church. I think the Liberal Catholic Church here in those days. And there was a shop, a Roman Catholic shop not far away, and I went over and I bought a cross. And the lady was dark, a little bit dark-skinned, had brilliant eyes, and somehow or other we kept looking at each other and feeling drawn a little, perhaps, in an impersonal way. So I took the liberty of saying, "Excuse me, but you are not a New Zealander at all, are you?" She said, "No, I am not." I said, "May I ask, what is your nationality?" She said, "I belong to the Druze people." Which of course reminded me of what I've just been saying. "Oh," I said, "the Druze religion is very profound philosophically, isn't it?" She said, "Yes, it is." And I said, in the words of, I never forgotten this, I said, "I believe they have an inner wisdom and teaching amongst the Druzes, do they not?" She looked at me so strongly and she said, yes, they have an inner and an inner and an inner. Smiling at me. And I withdrew. It's wonderful, you know, as you travel about, every now and again you come upon such experiences which tell you how this theosophical idea of the existence of the adepts is really widespread, however secretly it's preserved. But I mustn't allow myself to be distracted, really. Thus, studying our literature, well, it gradually becomes reasonably well informed, soundly based, as it were. One of our members, a German member, just after the close of the Second World War, had managed to get permission to leave Germany and attend a theosophical convention at Adyar. And with great joy, he accepted, particularly because from childhood he'd had one burning longing. And that burning longing was to see the pyramids again. He felt his life could never be fulfilled until he'd seen the pyramids. However, the boat arrived at the Egyptian port too late, and he was not able to go and see the pyramids. And this plunged him into a profound depression, as he told Sandra and me. And he told us that he was walking along one of the streets in Cairo, thus plunged in regret, depression. And a tall, distinguished-looking Arab walked up to him, looked him in the eyes, and said, "My brother, the pyramids are within you." Immediately he intuitively responded, he told us, and the whole of his sorrow left him at once. He was in a kind of exaltation for several weeks afterwards. There, I presume, one has an example of the intrusion upon one's life of one of the great masters, particularly in the time of acute distress. And if I had time, I could tell you many more, but I would just like to go on with a consideration with you of our subject. In the East, of course, the thoughts of our Indian brethren and of the large number of yogis and spiritual aspirants there throughout the East, they turn to the head of their religion. And for them, the Lord Gautama Buddha is a very great and very true reality. And they have studied and mastered all the teaching they can gain, not only about his life, but the marvelous wisdom which he gave to mankind. This is particularly true also in Tibet, where, of course, the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, presided over Buddhism before the withdrawal. And by the by, he is rightly named, I feel, having met him and spoken to him. He does carry about with him also a very real atmosphere, a power, I think I will say, of holiness. By the by, he was kind enough to attend, as you know, our centenary celebration in Adyar and to give an address. Just comes to my mind then, I would recommend to you all his latest book. It's quite wonderful. It's called the opening of the wisdom eye. I want to write it, some of you, I'll tell you after. The opening of the wisdom eye. It's all about meditation and the higher life and the awakening of the intuition, discipleship and so on. Now, may I presume and resume. Those of us who might thus intuitively respond, or intellectually and spiritually aspire, then there are certain steps that we can take to make the masters a greater reality, and even to reach the feet of that one who is destined to be our disciple. Our master. It is taught that we should make it a practice of deliberately and daily thinking reverently of such a great one. This is one of the valuable practices of mystic Roman Catholicism. Of all religions, really, it's called self-recollection. So that, I think this is important, friends, so that however much one may be involved in some external activity, there is one part of one's nature which is to some extent in a state of self-recollection. And where a knowledge of a particular master has been gained, think of him constantly as a, could I say the word, habit of one's spiritual life. Live with the master. Have him always within one's consciousness, even at the back of one's mind, and perform all services in his name, and invoke his power and his blessing and his healing grace continually wherever opportunity permits, until there becomes, could I say, built into one's consciousness the realization of at least that particular master, and therefore in principle the idea of adepts as a whole. And then again, one might, if so move, I suppose temperament would decide, one could will continually to become like him. A vision, a picture, a painting, which to one's mind seemed to represent him very well. Will continually, if that's one's temperament, that's what I'm going to grow up to be. I will to be like him. And then, of course, yes, I'd better be factual, hadn't I? Contrary motives and contrary conduct must be reduced to a minimum as soon as possible. Finally, disappear. Undesirable habits, which you've got built in a bit, mental and physical, these must be overcome as one attempts to draw nearer and nearer to one who ever stands ready to accept those thus moved. And then, when sincerely so moved, sincerity being an absolute necessity in occultism. When thus moved sincerely, then it is taught in our literature determinedly, powerfully, and continuously, according to available time and energy, dedicate the whole life to his service, to becoming his agent, however impersonally, and yes, of course, out amongst the world of men. About this, of course, one must be strictly and legally honest through and through and through, having built into one's nature, if one dare say so, the jewel of sincerity. Without that, there will be obstacles in the way. So in business, one must be quite truthful, mental and verbally, and utterly trustworthy, in fact, through and through and through. No hidden motives of gaining some personal prestige or power, if this should succeed. The master discerns that, of course, perfectly and instantly, and whilst understanding it and even appreciating it, will find it the possibility of a barrier. Open-heartedness, pure-heartedness, with nothing else in one's heart and in one's life but devotion and dedication to him, the adored guru. And thus the whole life becomes dedicated to his service and to becoming his disciple. And here may I remind that the path of discipleship is ever open, never closed. Cannot be closed. It's one of the laws of life to which the great adepts themselves are obedient. And when one thus selflessly moved and inspired begins to dedicate the life to one or other or more of the great ones, a response is assured. Even joining the society. For the great master Maurya wrote, you remember, when a person joins the Theosophical Society, I look at him. When a person joins the Theosophical Society, I look at them. That means, I presume, that you and I, and all of our members, throughout the beginning of the society to now, who have joined, have at least passed within the consciousness of one or other of the great adepts. And one presumes it will be those who were associated with our movement in early days. Master Maurya, the Master Kuthumi, both living together in Tibet, or beyond, the Master Dyulkul, the Master Hilarion, the Master Serapis Bey, the Master Tuitit Bey, the Master Jesus, and others of the great brotherhood who have emerged from their seclusion for our sakes and submitted themselves to the result. Some of which have been very harmful in building up the attitude of certain people towards the whole concept, which has become ridiculed. But even so, doubtless knowing, doubtless accepting it, they, out of love for their fellow men, and following this great principle, have allowed themselves to be brought into touch with us all. This remains, as I sometimes say and think I said last night, didn't I? May I repeat it? Not only along the lake shores of Palestine and the field paths of Judea and the village streets is it possible to hear that sweetest and wondrous of all voices, follow me, and I will make you to become fishers of men. That was 2,000 years ago, but the procedure has continued down to today and had existed literally millions of years earlier. My time is passing. What would happen? What would it be like? Supposing you or I thus being at the level of evolution and in the state of mind and heart necessary, and whose lives and freedom and health all contributed, I suppose necessary, and one's karma, all right. Supposing it happened that a great master did call one to become his disciple. In the East, doubtless, it could be direct, for there occasionally we learn they appear. In the West, in this rather turbulent time, perhaps less so visible. Then it is taught, read the Masters and the Path and other books. During the night hours, whilst the body is asleep, at the Master's command, the ego in the subtler bodies becomes drawn into his holy presence, fully conscious there. They see him, one who sums up all the highest perfections of which one had ever dreamt. Tall, perhaps, the brow lofty, broad, the eyes alight with a kind of inner fire, yet ever kindly, even humorous. He draws the aspirant near to him, and it is said asks the basic question, are you ready and willing under myself to undertake the treading of the way of holiness, the path of discipleship, and all that will be involved? One wonders and one thinks that in that presence only one answer could be given, though I learn that not everybody does assent. But surely in that holy presence only one answer to that privilege could be given from heart and mind: acceptance. And then it is taught, kneeling, perchance, at his feet or being near him, one is drawn into a close relationship with him, receives instruction in the necessary developments and improvements of character, and is given hints, perhaps, of work to be done day by day out back in the body. And a link is formed, closer than ever, under which the two. The master, the guru, and the disciple are, as it were, in the inner worlds, intimately at one. Then, of course, I presume there must be the awakening in the morning. Or, when awakening came, with the memory there or not, or as some who have passed through this experience have told me, a strangely new view of the world, an interior exaltation, a new zest for life, a new understanding of the way life can be lived, until eventually the whole is fully remembered and fully known, and then night after night, when necessary, when needed, the great meetings are resumed, but meaning less and less, because in consciousness it is taught in our literature and in mystical literature generally that in the inner selves, ego and of disciple and the master himself are ever one. And the master can intrude, use the disciple, pour forth through him his blessing, his inspiration, his healing grace, even if his servant in the physical world may not be too very well aware of the fact. Some of our lecturers and teachers have told me of remarkable cases, such as after a lecture, when they felt specially inspired, one of the audience have come up and said, "I have to thank you for my life. When I came to the door of this room, I decided that if this evening I did not receive an explanation of life which satisfied me in my present parlous condition, I was going to commit suicide. Having heard of theosophy through you, I am not going to do so." And in that, and in many, many other ways, open to us all in varying degree, for a master has looked at us, remember, passed within his consciousness, we have. Those thus temperamentally move, all being absolutely free, those thus temperamentally moved may, to one answer to my question, make the existence of the masters increasingly real to themselves. And this is a possibility, my brothers, today. And although there may not be some occult pronouncement, the master himself takes care that the disciple eventually knows what has occurred.
Tell that lovely story of the pines. I heard your cry under the pines.
Sandra reminds me of another story with which I will close. Told me by the person concerned, one of our great theosophical workers. She was an opera singer, and her voice left her, and else in her life broke away. She was in utter despair, could see nothing worth living for, so she decided to commit suicide. There was a very steep cliff, high, steep cliff, not far from where she lived. And she thought that would be the best place. She would throw herself over the cliff. So she went under the fir trees in a kind of plantation of firs over the great cliff. She stood there, and far down below were the rocks upon which she would fall. and just as she was about to leap, something happened in her. She said, "Oh, Master, Master, Master," not quite knowing why she did it. And instantly, her calm returned, her self-control returned, a measure of happiness, and she turned about back and faced life again. Well, to cut the story short, eventually she came into touch with Madame Blavatsky and H.P. and Colonel Olcott, and became his secretary and one of his close helpers at the time of the days before he died. And she told me this story herself. She was in the bedroom there at Adyar, where the colonel lay on his bed, dying. And quite unexpectedly, as happened in those days, the two great masters, the Master Moria and the Master Kuthumi, as they did, walked across the roof there into that door, and they stood one on either side of the colonel's bed. She knelt, she told me. I went on my knees behind one of them. It was the Master Kuthumi. And there he was with his, she reached forward, I suppose half unconsciously, and touched his garment to see, is it real? The Master knew and turned round and said, "Yes, it is I myself. I heard your cry beneath the pines." Changed her whole life still more. So you see, my brothers, it is as possible to become assured in one's own consciousness of the existence of the masters, of the pathway of discipleship, and the possibility of treading it even in this incarnation. The last thought has come to me that I should be closing. Whilst our Theosophical Society now moving into its second 100 years must and will of course continue to teach all that is embraced in the idea theosophy, divine wisdom. Yes, I think from some writings that it is equally important that the Theosophical Society should continue in this second century to teach of the existence of the masters of the wisdom, of the way of discipleship, and the possibility of treading it to its end. And that this aspect of our work needs also to have its place from our platform, in our programs, in our literature. The wondrous idea, the path of discipleship. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Jeffrey, for a very inspiring talk. To conclude the meeting this morning, Jeffrey has agreed to conduct a short meditation to unite us in thought, particularly as the subject this morning is one that has been very inspiring. Thank you.
With pleasure. I will just slowly repeat what is known as a Kabbalist prayer. With a pause, shall I? A pause between each line. Universal God. I'll say it, please. Universal God. one life, one light, one power. Thou all in all, beyond expression, beyond comprehension. O nature, thou something from no thing, thou symbol of wisdom, in myself I am nothing, in thee I am I live in thee, live thou in me, and bring me out of the region of self into the eternal light. Ah.